speaker, Dominique Gravel. Dominique is professor at the Université du Québec à Rimouski, where he holds a Tier 2 Canada Research Chair in Continental Ecosystem Ecology. He received his PhD from the University of Quebec at Montreal and subsequently did postdoctoral research at McGill in the Department of Biology with Fred Quichard, Michel Lahore, and others. He also spent some time doing postdoctoral research at the Université de Montpellier in France prior to taking up his position now at UQAR. Dominique is another generalist, somebody who has no fear to tackle big problems with equations, with experiments, with field surveys. He is one of the most creative young researchers in Canada, and he's always got something stimulating to say about some of the biggest topics. So I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say about ecological networks in the Anthropocene.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Andy, for the nice introduction. It's a pleasure for me today to make this presentation, and I hope that we're going to have great exchanges with it after, because it's still an ongoing work we're doing at the moment. I'm part of several working groups where we try to extend the application of ecological network ecology to big questions in ecology. So we're trying to make that feel more practical, more operational on the field to study questions related to major biodiversity issues. And we recently started to develop new approaches for modeling ecological networks in the Anthropocene. And that's one of the outcome I'm going to present today. And every feedback is more than welcome. So I'm going to make the argument here that we need a novel approach to essentially quantify biodiversity in a way that we take into account ecological interactions and all the diversity of ecological interactions, because these matter for things like ecosystem functioning and the services that they do provide to humans. And so current approaches are essentially focusing on mapping species distribution. So if you look at the big scenarios that are produced worldwide when you're seeing big projections on the future of biodiversity in, let's say, 100 years from now, most of the approaches are building on species distribution models. So that's a tool that was inherited by studies in biogeography. And that tool is essentially centered on the species itself. It doesn't take advantage of the rich information that is contained in the community. And communities, we now know, that are important to think about. You need to think about interactions when you're trying to solve problems of ecosystem functioning and services, because the interactions do matter. You can lose key species that, because of their interactions, will change dramatically the functioning of an ecosystem. So just mapping species worldwide is not enough. We need to go further. And there's been many revolutions over the last, say, the last 10 years in biogeography. So now people are thinking about functional diversity, for instance. So that was a paper that was published about a year ago by Devin Wu and colleagues, where they look at the if the rare species do have particular traits. So losing rare species, does it have a huge impact on the functional diversity of a community? That's one of the trend at the moment in modeling biodiversity worldwide and making big scenarios about what's going to happen in the future. Another one is using phylogenetic information as well. So in cases where you can't quantify traits, you cannot quantify functions, it is hypothesized that the phylogenetic history of a community is a good proxy of its functional diversity. And so people started to look at what's the impact of losing different branches in the phylogeny. And in this particular study, for instance, they look at if you're looking at the tree of plants, big trees of plants, birds, and mammals, is there random extinctions in the three if you're looking about change in rain? The red and the green species that are illustrated here on these phylogenies are the ones that are expected to go extinct, because they're going to have a hard time tracking their new environment in the climate change context. And so they looked at if climate change will produce non-random species extinction sequences in the phylogenies. But I'm going to make the argument that we need to open that problem and look at what's under the hood, as Jen said earlier. So looking at interactions themselves and trying to map these worldwide and see what's happening when we're going to think about climate change and our global change and interactions. This is the central objective of the work that I'm going to present today. And so one of the problems is that food webs are messy, and ecological networks in general are even worse, because you're having hundreds of species and thousands of links between them. So it's hard to have a general approach, one that could make that could adapt to different systems, taking into account all of the specific distribution of the links that are in networks. And so one way is the network approach is to just compress that information into a couple of metrics that you can follow. And it has been quite successful so far. So you can reduce a web to, let's say, in this case, a bunch of modules, and look at the relationship between those modules, and that will already give you some information. When you have a network like that, you can calculate a bunch of statistics like connectance, the number of links, the number of species, and you also have statistics about how the links are distributed. You could think about, the pointer is not there anymore. It's just right here. Okay, so when you have a network like that, there are a bunch of metrics you can compute and use them and track them to compare networks and make predictions. One successful attempt recently, for instance, was to compute the frequency distribution of different motifs. So when you have a network like that, you can find recurrent smaller community modules. So here, for instance, you have a module of apparent competition. Here you have one of exploitative competition. Here you have a food chain. And you can characterize a given network by the frequency distribution of these motifs. And they do have, the frequency distribution of the motifs has been shown to have a profound impact on the functioning of the network. So there are a bunch of ways to compress that information. And these have been linked to different properties. And there have been studies in different phases. So the early phase of network research was coming from the hypothesis that May presented a while ago, that complex systems should be less stable than simpler ones. And so in the early phase of the food web and the network ecology, people were looking at non-random features of real ecosystems, because Robert May was making the was studying randomly generated ecosystems. And people in the early phase, so in the 70s, early 80s, they were looking at the impacts of these non-random properties we do observe in nature, what's their impact on stability. Later, in the late 80s, early 90s, people started to gather data, and they started to test in a very naive way some predictions of the theory that was elaborated by May. And so, for instance, Martinez has been looking for a while at the relationship between the number of links and the number of species you encounter in a network. These were rather naive approaches. Just as a first step, you start gathering data and you look what are the overall relationship. And then things got finer because people in the network literature starting to use tools developed from physics. And so in the early 2000s, people in physics started to study the tolerance of networks to species loss, to the loss of nodes or the loss of links. And in some papers following that in ecology, they've looked at, well, we have that theory in physics, what's happening in ecological systems. So they use that approach to study the impact of species extinctions in food webs. And they found, for instance, that non-random species extinctions, when you're targeting the most connected species, for instance, it has a huge impact on the persistence of the whole network. Well, if there are just random extinctions occurring in the networks, networks are pretty resilient to these extinctions. But all those studies were essentially local. So that's the first three phases, I would say, of the network ecology history. Now we have to move at a larger scale. We have to think about what's happening when you're moving from the local to the regional scale. How do networks are organized, and what's their functioning at that scale? And so we started to study this a couple of years ago. We use a very simple and classic data set in ecology, the one of Heavens that was published in the 90s. So that's a large data set containing about 50 lakes for which phytoplankton, zooplankton, and the fish communities were sampled. And then the network was built. So from the literature, Heavens inferred what are the interactions among all of the different species found in that food web, building up what he called a meta web. So this is here the representation of that meta web, all potential interactions among all pairs of species found in that set of 50 lakes. And I started to play with that data and found pretty rapidly that the properties of that meta web are quite different from the ones that we have in local iteration of that food web. So when you're moving from the large scale where you have about 100 species and you're just sampling that meta web and have, let's say, here 37 and here 19 species, you find properties of these networks that are quite different from the meta web. So there's some variation between the local and the global here that we need to understand. And we need to better understand what are the processes underlying that variation. So we started to play with that. We developed a theory that I will not detail here, but just keep in mind there's a big difference between a network at the local and at the regional level. And I was talking about spatial variation in food web structures, so we found rapidly in that data set, for instance, that connectance does vary with pH. So as you increase pH, the connectance tends to get lower. And there was a significant interaction between that for that relationship between the size of the lake. So the relationship was much stronger for small lakes than for large lakes. And so there is spatial variation in food web structure here that is measured with a very coarse metric, which is connectance. After that, we started to look further into the spatial variation of networks. And we developed a metric to compute the biodiversity. I don't want to go into much details about the definition of diversity. Here is just a measure of the turnover between two communities. And in a first time, we computed what's the turnover in species composition, and then we started to look at what's the turnover in network structure instead. So we had observations for about 100 of different networks, and we compared all pairs of networks together. We had one that was taking the overall measure of similarity between two networks, and a second one that was just looking at the variation of the interactions themselves, factoring out the effect of species composition in the analysis. So we found that networks do vary in space, so there's considerable biodiversity in both cases because of species turnover. As you can see here, the more turnover you have in species composition, the more turnover you have in the whole network structure. But that variation, if you just look at the variation of the link, so the biodiversity of interactions, it's totally independent from the biodiversity of species composition. So networks do vary in space because of species turnover, but also because there is some turnover of the links. And that's what we're currently trying to better understand. What's the underlying cause of that, and what's the consequences? What are the consequences of link turnover? And to better understand that, I'll go back to one of the potential drivers of biodiversity, which is the variation of niches in spaces. But trying to apply the niche concept to networks is pretty hard because of conflicting interpretations of the niche. So Chase earlier tried to solve the opposition between two classic representation of ecological niches, which I will just expand further in the next slide. But essentially, so they define the niche as the description of the environmental conditions that allow a species to maintain itself and the effects that species has on these environmental conditions. One of the problems we have with that definition when it comes to apply it at the biogeographic scale is that it's not really operational. It's hard, it's quite easy, that's what a species distribution model do, it's quite easy to represent the set of environmental conditions that allow a species to maintain itself, but it's much harder to position the species into its, the space that it, forget about it, I'm going to move to the next slide. Anyway, so one typical way of viewing this is, the Grinnellian niche is this the environmental space where a species could maintain itself, so it has several refinements over the year. So basically here you have a representation of where the species, the set of environmental conditions, E1 and E2, where a species could maintain itself. Depending on the types of spatial dynamics and interactions you can have some refinements of these, of this representation, but it's essentially the same. So that's the Grinnellian niche. And the other one is the food web niche, which is quite different. So that's the niche food web, the niche model of food web interaction that was developed by Williams and Martinez early in the 2000s. So basically you have a representation of here one single niche axis that range from 0 to 1. You position one given species, that's its niche position, and along that axis it's going to feed on all species that have their niches within a given range around a centroid. So this definition of the niche is quite different from the Grinnellian one. And there has been no real attempt right now to try to reconcile them. But fortunately, recently, people started to fit that model, and rapidly we found that that niche axis could be represented by traits, essentially. Or at least when it is possible to fit to data and establish, given a matrix of interaction, establish what's the niche position of a species. So now we come with a representation of the niche that takes into account both the effect of the environment and the effect that the species has on the community. So here you have the environment. For any given species, you can think about its growth rate. It's going to be found in within the area here delimited by the dashed line. The species will be found in that area where the growth rate is larger than zero. So that's the original Grinnellian definition of the niche. And so the red species here, for instance, its environmental niche will be found within these dashed line. And then in a second axis here, you can represent the food web dimension the Eltonian dimension of the niche. So you can represent here the niche position of the target species, the red one, and its centroid and the range on the species it feeds on. So you have a representation of all the species here. And so the square here in the middle essentially represent the species, the niche of the species we're looking at. So this representation here takes into account both the Grinnellian and the Eltonian dimensions of the niche. But now we need to put that into practice, so quantify that mathematically and try to fit it to data and use it after for making biodiversity scenarios. And so for that, we're going to consider a first stochastic variable, X, that represents simply the occurrence of a species in a given community. And we're going to the variable X takes a value of 1 if the species is present, and it takes a value of 0 if it's absent, simply. And we have the variable L, which represents the occurrence of an interaction between two species at that location. And for an interaction to occur, it depends trivially on the occurrence of the two species, and also that interaction must occur. So at the end, what we're trying to represent is the probability that you have a link, you have the two species present in the community. So we could extend that further. So this is a joint probability, and we could represent it as a function of a marginal probability, and here a conditional probability. So here the term here is the probability of observing a link given that the two species are present in the community. And here is the probability of observing the two species. So we have a representation here that is essentially our integrated niche framework. So here you have essentially the Eltonian niche, and here you have the Grinnellian niche, where you can eventually put the effect of the environment into that equation here. We could refine the model with the addition of conditions on the environment. So we could eventually take into account different variables such as temperature, pH, and so forth. So we could do it from the perspective of the link itself. So what's the probability of observing an interaction given the presence of the two species and local environmental conditions? And you can also look at the probability of observing the two species given the environment. And eventually, these two could even be refined further. For instance, that surprisingly goes back to the pi representation we had earlier. So the probability of observing the two species could be represented first as a first approximation in a neutral way, so simply as the product of the probability of observing the two species given the environment. In this case, co-occurrence is simply neutral. The two species, if they are more frequent at the regional level, they are more likely to occur to co-occur, but that will essentially depend on their individual occupancy. You don't take into account their association. And so we tried to fit the model. Oh, I have to speed up. I'm going to speed up quite a bit. So we try to fit the model to empirical data. That was data coming from a study on the effect of habitat modifications on network structure in tropical areas. That's just an example of one local network. I won't go into details here. And we compare the different models using the likelihood of observing each network. And essentially, we found that the networks do vary in space because of two things. So first, because the links are influenced by the environment. So some interactions do happen in some some environments, and they do not happen in other environments. So it's not just a condition on having the two species present. In some environments, the interaction might not occur. And of course, because there's a lot of turnover in species composition over space, there's eventually a signal of that on network structure. But I'm going to skip details here because I really want to go rapidly to the application of that framework. So eventually what we want to do is be able to project future ecological networks in response to global changes. So at first, the challenge is to represent the meta-web, because with global changes, such as climate warming, we're going to have novel communities for which we don't have a priori on the interactions. So we need to infer the interactions, because the species currently do not co-occur, so we could not know if they will interact or not. So we develop a method based on the niche model for food webs. We develop a method to parameterize the model based on the well-known relationship between predator and prey body size. And using that method, we eventually inferred the meta web. So here you have just the simple meta web based on only the predator and prey body size relationship. And here you have a meta web factoring in the effect of co-occurrence, so removing by the white area here all the links that are impossible because the two species do not co-occur. And we did apply that to the Mediterranean Sea, where we mapped current networks. So here is just a representation of the connectance of the pelagic food webs in the coastal areas of the Mediterranean Sea. And here's a projection in about 100 years from now. And we found there's, in many areas, overall, there's an increase in connectance because a species lose links faster than they lose, faster than species richness is declining in these areas. But most of all, what we were able to do after, with that in hand, is to try to relate the vulnerability in terms of the environmental niche or the Grinnellian niche and the vulnerability in terms of the Eltonian niche. So here, for instance, you have the variation in generality. So species that are gaining links, species that are losing prey. Here is the variation in vulnerability. So species that are here in the upper panel gaining predators and here losing predators. And the color correspond to the variation in range size of the different species. And what we essentially found is that there's no significant relationship between these three measures of vulnerability. So the species, for instance, that are losing the largest part of their range are not necessarily the ones that are losing the most of their prey. And so that adds a further dimension to our assessment of species vulnerability. So just to come back to that integrated representation of the niche, I think it brings us to a new representation of communities. It emphasized the need to quantify communities not only by species list, but also with some knowledge of the interactions they do have with other species. That will bring us much closer to an assessment of global change impact on ecosystem functioning. And I'm going to skip that last one and just finish with acknowledgments. Thanks.
So time for one quick question whilst we switch computers.
Yes.
Andrew, can you get up to the microphone just there?
Presumably the quality of the analyses that you can do depend on the quality of the initial food webs that are developed.
Yep.
And so I was imagining that a lot of the turnover and linkages among communities, among lakes for instance, could just be the result of imperfect sampling information within those lakes. Is there any way to correct for that?
Yeah. So one good advantage of this framework is that at the end you have a precise estimate of how good or how bad you've been about in the evaluation of the link. Because in reality, it's much harder to evaluate the interaction between a pair of species that are, at least one of them is rare. It's just because one is rare, it's hard to quantify its interaction. And so that you get it very rapidly from that framework, which you don't usually when you're just going on the field and recording naively networks.
So it's quite interesting because now that people are doing environmental genomics, they'll just sample the water and find many species are present that they didn't actually get when they surveyed
yep.
the lake.
Yep.
Great. Thank you.
Feel free to...